Recently, I chatted with author Sophia Lambton about her book, The Callas Imprint, a centennial biography. Now, if you are a fan of Callas, which I am, this book offers you a deep dive into her life, born from extensive research, debunking popular theories, and offering an authentic portrayal. Now, this book was 12 years in the making, and the Callas imprint showcases never-before-seen correspondence and archival documents worldwide, closing in on the self-contradictions of Callas, her attitudes and habits, with empathic scrutiny. It swivels readers through the singer's on- and off-stage scenes, and flux of fears and dreams. The double life of all performers. Please enjoy. Sophia, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Stephen.
And I must ask, how's the weather in England?
Well, it's miserable. This is the way it always is. It's grey. There is no such thing as sun, really, in
right.
England. We have it sometimes for 5 days in July or August, but last year there was no sun in July or August, and it came in September, which was interesting.
Yeah. The weather here in Toronto has been wackadoodle. Yesterday it went up to 21 degrees. And now today it dropped by 15 and is British weather. It's overcast, dark, and quite disgusting outside.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to be doing a podcast with you and really excited to talk about Maria Callas, because not only was she brilliant, but a very, very interesting character. And I spent quite a long time with your book, and I'm excited to talk about it. So let's sort of start from the perspective of this extraordinary and at times self-contradictory figure, Maria Callas. What really drew you to write about her and sort of tackle this multifaceted individual?
You know, when I track back my own analysis of anybody, any person, I think that my acquaintance with Maria Callas, the person, not the singer, I should say, although I don't like to separate them. I should make that clear from the beginning. I don't like to separate them. But what I mean is the first time I heard her speak and saw her speak in an interview, that completely revolutionized the way I would approach any other person, famous or not famous, talented or not talented, the rest of my life and you know, onwards. I was seven when I first heard about Maria Callas, because I remember passing a train station that had a little billboard advertising one of those very best of Maria Callas compilation albums, which, when you think about it, is amazing, because I can't imagine there being any Maria Callas billboard in London now, or most cities outside of Italy, or Greece. But anyway, I didn't know much about her until I was 13, and my father introduced me to opera. And even so I began to love the Callas voice quite quickly, not immediately, but quite quickly. I would get obsessed with her recordings, but I wasn't interested in her as a person, because any time I looked her up, I was greeted by Wikipedia or Google with these headlines or summaries that suggested she was a tantrum-throwing, spoiled, self-indulgent diva with this dramatic soap opera life. And I didn't care to enter that. I've heard a lot about misbehaving celebrities, talented or not, and I didn't care to dissect that kind of personality. And I don't know, maybe I owe YouTube algorithms my destiny, because when I was 17, I put her interviews on, or maybe they just came on automatically in that autoplay function of YouTube while I was maybe doing homework last year of high school. And I thought, this is such a balanced, lucid, rational human being. This is someone completely different to the person I've read about. So I was very, very determined to find out further through listening to her interviews. And I'm not the first person, and I shan't be the last person who's had this experience, because I had to transgress the myths. So the myths were, back then, she was this tantrum-throwing diva. She abandoned her career for this Greek billionaire who later married Jackie Kennedy, Which was, it's the total falsehood, that whole construction. But I believed it, and I believed it actually for quite a long time until I really began to listen to more of her interviews, to read books about her, some of which do have some truthful information, including quotations from her letters, sometimes entire transcriptions of the letters. And then further on, when I was finally researching my book, when I finally began to find her correspondence, some correspondence that had never been published before, chiefly between her and her manager, Sandra Gorlinsky, who managed her career from 53 right up to her death. It was a journey in that, yes, as you mentioned, she is a self-contradictory figure. So at the beginning, I was very, very young, and I was kind of a fangirl. So I was very eager to lap up everything she was saying and, you know, say, yeah, I believe Maria. And then you see she contradicts herself, and that's no longer possible. You can't say one thing one day and then the opposite the next, and it can't be true in both instances. So what I did was, in planning this book on my computer, in addition to having chronological documents for every single chapter, I would have full of extreme amounts of finite detail about everything I could find out, what she ate that day, what she wore that day, whom she met up with that day. I also had a separate document called Characteristics and Features, in addition to other separate documents about things that may have been ongoing in her life, like medical conditions. I had one for that. I had a document containing critics' thoughts that were timeless, so they may not have been pertaining to a particular review. And the ones with characteristics and features, I would write everything from the smallest details, like the kind of jewelry and diamonds she liked, and her favorite pasta dishes, to what does Maria Callas think about marriage in 1957 versus 1974? And so I track those opinions. And then I had to distribute them across my chapters so that it would be well balanced, because of course, it's a very difficult thing writing biography, because there are traits we carry all through life, and then there are things that completely change. So things like relationship with religion. When she was quite young, Callas was relatively religious, Greek Orthodox, not very, but somewhat. And then later on, she became, well, slightly more agnostic and more of a believer in fate as opposed to a god, I would say, slightly. And of course, the relationship with the voice, which is an entire relationship in itself that had to come up more often than her relationship with either Onassis or her husband, Giovanni Battista Manigini, or her mother or her sister or any friend or colleague. So it was an enormous work, but I did want to delineate those self-contradictions, because I believe a lot of biographers don't do that, not only biographers, but documentarians, because it's very easy to just say, I want this narrative, I want this angle, we're going to use this quote, we're going to turn a blind eye to these other quotations that contradict that.
Obviously, you mentioned the fact that, yes, the media tends to portray her one way, and I did want to touch on her as, well, young Callas as the child prodigy, and obviously a part of her psychological makeup was derived from her upbringing and her relationship with her mother. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it is true that Maria Callas had a very exigent and I would say uncaring mother, Evangelia, who was a very brassy, stereotypical stage mother. It doesn't really get worse than what she was. She really had absolutely no concern about either of her daughters' well-beings. In the beginning, she wanted them both to be famous. It was just this idea that, oh, well, I didn't make it as a big star, so you're going to be famous. In terms of how did this impact Maria Callas? Yes, in retrospect, later on, she would say, my mother wanted me to be a Shirley Temple or a Deanna Durbin, so a big child prodigy, and this was wrong. And parents should not raise their children this way. That's true. But that was an adult Maria Callas thinking of a child Maria Callas. And also probably that was influenced by how much that relationship became more and more acrimonious as time went on. If you go back all the way back to little baby Maria, you're talking about a girl who, according to her cousin Mary Annexy, whom I interviewed, is playing with a ball and singing at the same time. In Mary Annexy's words, she warbled like a bird. And, you know, taking the shawl of Marianne Esky's cousin, also her cousin, many cousins, Helen R. Forrest, and singing with the shawl at the piano. And later on, when she's 11 years old, she's in her own recollection, in Callas's own recollection, she was pacing the room singing the Habanera and Je suis Titania from the opera Mignon. she was listening to Lily Pons and saying, well, I don't think she's that great. I'm going to be a greater singer than she is. She was, I think slightly later on, completely enamored with Rosa Poncel, who would be her idol, probably the only female singer, definitely, that she idolized continuously through life. So there was that. Then there was the, you could call it bullying from her mother, go and enter this radio contest. And yes, she entered plenty of radio contests. At one point, Jack Benny was master of ceremonies, but he didn't remember that when they later met at President Kennedy's birthday in May 62, when Marilyn Monroe sang Happy Birthday, Mr. President. She found it stressful, of course, as she got older, but that never undermined her own compulsion to be the best and to work extremely hard. So her mother, Evangelia, took her and her sister, Jackie, to Athens when she was just 13 years old. And that was the conclusion of Maria Callas's academic education completely. After that, she only studied voice and the history of music and the theory of music at two different conservatoires, neither of which she actually graduated from, because she didn't receive diplomas. She also managed to fail her exam at one of them in the history of music, because that wasn't her forte, being academic. But her mother made her audition for the National Conservatory from pretty much the moment she got to Athens at 13. She had to tell them she was 17 to apply. And later on, Callas would say, that was the first lie I ever told. So yeah, there was tremendous pressure. At one point also, later on in Greece, she was secretly seeing her teacher, her vocal coach, who would continue to be her dear vocal coach and close one, Elvira Hidalgo, the Spanish soprano, at the same time as continuing to have lessons with another vocal coach, Maria Trivella, who Callas would say had an odd method of placing the voice too nasally. And Maria Trivella later on apparently felt somewhat betrayed by this. This was more kind of Evangelia's suggestion. So yeah, obviously you can wonder, what would Maria Callas, the young girl or even the teenager, have been like as a singer? How would her training have gone had it not been for Evangelia? Would she have been better off psychologically? I don't know, but I still think she would have been extremely determined to succeed and not discouraged by any obstacle.
I do find it interesting. Obviously, in preparation to speaking with you, I was listening to a lot of Maria Callas. And it always blows my mind that obviously many, many people worshipped her. Some hated her voice. I think it just blows me away, quite frankly. And as you say, it was along that journey, it was influenced by individual teachers rather than institutions.
I would say that's correct. Yeah.
So what did that development look like in terms of her vocal flexibility, tenacity, that sort of thing?
Well, if we start right at the beginning of what was Maria Callas born with that made her voice unique, because even though there is an enormous layer of technique going on there, it is an extraordinary instrument. It is extraordinary, the amount of detail that I couldn't find out an enormous amount about precisely what anatomically made it extraordinary, but I did find out that a doctor once observed it had unusual musculature in two vocal cords. And producer Walter Legg of EMI, which is now Warner Music, said she had a very long rib cage, which I think accounts for that bottle sound that is utterly, it's incomparable. If you hear it, there's no way that timbre belongs to another singer. Mm-hmm. He also mentioned that the upper palate of her mouth was shaped like a Gothic arch, which is obviously a strange shape. So that acoustic, and it's funny when you read that, you immediately get a sense of that acoustic, the reasons that acoustic comes out as it does. My feeling is, of course, I don't know about Joan Sutherland's mouth. I don't know about her mouth, but my feeling is she probably didn't have a Gothic arch-shaped upper palate. In terms of teachers, she was very lucky in that she and Elvira Hidalgo bonded immediately about following the instruction of Manuel Garcia, who had been a very, very famous vocal pedagogue in the 19th century and father of Pauline Garcia Verdot, bel canto all the way. So legato being the most prominent principle of this schooling, singing in an even line, very smoothly, mastering every single one of the technical ornaments, trills, all kinds of roulades, accecatores, appoggiatores, but at the same time not adding them just for the sake of embellishment. So from quite an early age, she, courtesy of Elvira Hidalgo, and later on also courtesy of Maestro, her favorite conductor, Tullio Serafin, she was told that Rossini hated additional embellishments to his scores. She would later say that Rossini had apparently said, "Wouldn't opera be wonderful if there were no singers?" So she gets this kind of, she called it a straitjacket of teaching. And she later on, together with Tullio Serafin, oh no, I should mention before we get to that part, from a very young age, she was preparing very difficult arias and getting used to them very, very easily. So she was warming up with Casta Diva while she was doing the dishes, according to Elvira Hidalgo. She enjoyed warming up with D'Amor Solari Rose from Il Trovatore. So that way, actually, it predisposed her to not enjoy vocalizing. So she didn't like vocalizing. She didn't like any of those exercises you hear singers doing in their dressing rooms before a performance. She would always warm up with the biggest pieces because that unraveled her voice, she felt. So that is that speaks to the technical side of things. And then Tullio Serafin really got her to look at music so as to understand that she was being a character, she was incarnating a person. So she would later say, he said to me to think, if I were to say this recitative, how would I say it? And that way, she was getting rid of what I call them. Well, I got this from her because I was a teenager when I was learning this from Maria Callas. I can't say I knew that much about opera. I had loved it for a while, but the foundation of my own operatic education came from listening to Callas's interviews and reading her interviews. That there was a very, very long trend of bad taste in opera that unfortunately I have to admit continues till today, of the very loud high notes and taking a breath to make a high note even louder or longer, and adding trills where there ought to be, adding coloratura where there's already enough, adding cadenzas and cavalettas where there's already enough. And she was disciplined to perform in what she felt was good taste. And that's something that is completely unmissable when you listen to Maria Callas at any stage of her career, even when her voice was in shreds at the end. You never think, oh, that was vulgar. Well, that's not true. Actually, we will come to a certain performances where she may have done vulgar things in the beginning and at the early point of her career. So I shan't say you never think that's not vulgar, but you rarely think that's vulgar, is what I mean. In terms of the development of the voice, a lot of people say, well, she had this big, heavy, oil-like, dark voice, and then she lost a ton of weight and it became this slim, one thin voice, just like she was very, very slim. I don't know to what extent that's true. I will say that even before she was very slim, she could do a very slim, vulnerable, endearing timbre. For instance, when she sang Gilda in Rigoletto in Mexico in 52, that was a very cute timbre. So it is to do with vocal manipulation as well as possibly later on being connected to the weight loss. But it's hard to speculate about that because ultimately, who knows?
And let's touch on, I think it was 1941. There's war, there's poverty. Maria's sort of sent out as the breadwinner. What did that look like for her?
Well, it was a terrible period, and later on, she would, in terms of self-contradictions, you've got an interview where she says, "Oh, they were very painful, the war years. I'd rather not speak of them, for fear of touching wounds that haven't healed." And then many years later, she said, "Well, yes, it was hard, but hardship does one good." So, that's just an example, one of the many examples of how do I assess Maria Callas's time in a period when she has discussed it in different ways years after that. Obviously, it was a horrible period. Greece, Athens in the World War, we're on 41, but later on in December 1944, a civil war broke out between the Greek communists and the British-supported Greek allies. that was very, very bloody, and some say far more destructive than the Second World War in Greece itself, or at least in Athens itself. So yeah, she had to face destitution. She would walk for long tracks of kilometers to beg farmers to spare her cabbage leaves and tomatoes. She was already performing. So in 41, she's 17. She's already performing, getting a meager salary from the National Theatre, where she sang Franz von Suppe's opera Boccaccio, and later on Tosca, which was her first full opera adult debut. Her first ever debut was Santuzza in Cavaliere Rusticana at the age of 15. It was really hard to get food because even on the black market, no amount of money was enough. So her mother would send her to her aunt Sophia's house to raid the cupboards for food because Sophia's husband, Yorgos, was storing it illegally in their cupboard. He was storing excess food compared to what he was legally allowed to have. And she was a real comrade in this period, actually, because she would take her own complimentary opera tickets from the National Theatre, as well as those of her colleagues, and she would barter them in exchange for food that she would bring back to her colleagues. And she kind of capitalized on her reputation already back then as a locally well-known singer. So, for example, there was a butcher who liked her voice, and he introduced her to an Italian official who was in charge of supplying provisions to the troops. So that helped her because in exchange for that, she would have got some spaghetti. Later on, she went through some really hectic episodes. Of course, she was in Athens, which was occupied by Italian forces, and she wanted to learn Italian, but she didn't want to learn it with Italians because they were the enemy. So she learned it with some doctors who'd studied in Italy. She made a bet with her coach, Elevated Hidalgo, that she could learn it in 3 months, and she did. Although I should mention that if anybody has ever, anyone listening who knows Italian, if you have ever read Maria Callas's Italian letters, you will know that her grammar and her spelling are not up to scratch. And that applies for Maria Callas in every single language, including English, which was her mother tongue. So in 1943, if we go on a bit into the war, she was doing Tosca on the same night as a concert where she had to perform a Handel aria, a Rossini one, and Io son l'umile ancella from Adriana Lecouvreur. But as we know, Tosca's entrance in Tosca is not immediate. So she's got a bit of time before she rushes in with Mario, Mario, Mario. So she had to rush between the two theatres in Athens. And this is war-torn Athens. So, destitution, rubble everywhere, probably the stench of smoke and of God knows what else. I mean, obviously, it was a horrible, horrible experience. Thankfully, also, I forgot to mention that her sister Jackie's boyfriend, Milton Imbrikos, supplied them with a lot of amenities. At one point later on, Callas worked for the office of the British headquarters. She was in charge of distributing secret mail. And the real hideous episode of the World War for her wasn't, as I mentioned before, it wasn't necessarily to do with the World War so much as to do with the Civil War that broke out in December 44. Okay, I may have said that incorrectly, but much later on, she lived in the Red Zone, which was very dangerous because it was occupied by the Greek People's Liberation Army, and she had to go to work to the White Zone, which was where the British headquarters was, which was a safe zone. She had to make the trek by foot to save money. So it definitely, if you think about all of that, those kinds of things happening on a daily basis, an instance where she had a terrible allergic reaction because she was allergic to various dry legumes. That kind of thing is happening every day. The struggle for food, the struggle, the questioning, what is going to happen next? What is going to happen outside my house next? And that really made Maria Callas an adult. And who knows, given that she didn't have a great deal of parenting by her mother. Her mother had dumped their father, left him back in New York when she had left the city with Jackie and Maria, when Maria had been 13 in 37. Maybe if she'd been born in a different time, or at least actually just maybe if she'd stayed in New York, she would have been more naive, less strong, less prepared to battle the battlefield of opera that she later faced.
Yeah, I was just as you were speaking, I was just thinking about that she had to overcome so much adversity that made her stronger. And sure, I mean, paparazzi may have looked at her as a bit crusty at times, but quite frankly, I would be a bit crusty if I'd gone through all of that.
I was born in 92, and I have this to me is a horror film.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the sheltered, at least living where I do in London, UK. I'm of the shelter generation. So it's amazing.
Yeah. And you mentioned Tosca, of course. I mean, she was known for so many different roles, and I just sort of picked one of the obvious ones, Tosca, which she performed many, many times. How, in your analysis, did the role evolve as she matured as a singer?
I don't know if I even came to a conclusion entirely on that. Of course, I had ideas about it, but when I was writing the book and even reading my own text, first of all, perhaps your Callas loving listeners will know this already, so I'm sorry if I'm boring anyone here, but Maria Callas did not like Gloria Tosca. She did not like that character. She thought she was a flake. She thought she was self-indulgent, excessive, gawky. She called her a grand guignol. So basically this slapstick, farcical character. And I have to say that I can see where that comes from. I don't understand. I mean, she doesn't have a great deal of elegance. You can't see a Catherine Deneuve kind of Tosca, you know? So that the thing that makes Tosca advantageous from this perspective is that you can take a very overacting soprano who perhaps has very bad taste in trills or ornaments, length, extending top notes. And as a critic, you can actually attribute that to, well, Gloria Tosca is a bad actress. She's a stage actress. I think Gloria Tosca was probably a bad actress because she was just so melodramatic. And of course, I don't know if you, of course, I don't know, maybe Adriana Lecouvreur was a good actress, I'm going to assume. But just the fact that Gloria Tosca's character from Victorien Sardou's play, turning up in a Puccini opera, my feeling is she's a bad actress. So if we hear the Mexico Tosca, July 52, so that was Callas at the age of 28, it is a bit vulgar. You've got those gulps, that kind of tear in the voice that Callas would actually later talk about in reference to Beniamino Gigli. And she would say, well, Gigli cried a lot, I disliked him. She would say that in her Juilliard masterclasses many years later. But you can kind of hear it in her voice that she's overdoing it with the histrionics. It's not pretty, but it's very dramatic. And again, as I said before, I think as a critic or just as an opera lover, you can listen to that kind of performance and say, well, Gloria Tosca's not supposed to be all composed and let alone reserved. So, you know, where do you draw the line about what's vulgar vocalization or vulgar embellishment and what's faithful to the music, especially given this is also Puccini and Verismo. But by the time we get to 53, which is the legendary studio recording with Tito Gobbi, she's already molding the voice. So you've already got some gentleness in Tosca that wasn't there before, because I would say that in July 52, she was quite brassy and, you know, very loud. And you can envisage Mario being scared of this Tosca. And Mario shouldn't really, I mean, Mario has worse things to fear than Tosca, you know? So that shouldn't, he shouldn't fear the battle axe, Gloria Tosca. By 53, she's being more flirtatious. So she's getting that girlishness, the coquette side of Tosca into the character. When she says, fal gli occhi neri, you know, make the Marchesa d'Attavanti's, d'Attaventi, what is her name? Attavanti, yeah, make her eyes brown. Because obviously her eyes are blue, and immediately Gloria Tosca so jealous. As we know, this is how Scarpia later on manages to manipulate her by saying, oh, Mario was with a pretty blonde lady when you were gone. She is capturing that character. There are, as you know, as everyone who has taken any interest in Callas knows, there are many Toscas, and Tosca's also the only character that Callas incarnated that was captured on tape or on film. Well, I should mention there are very, very short snippets of her as Violetta in the Visconti 55 Traviata, silent footage, and also as Madame Butterfly Cho-Cho San, silent silent footage, but they are minute, they are tiny, so they don't really serve us well. But Tosca was, the second act was filmed three times. The first time for the Ed Sullivan Show in 56, the second time for a Parisian gala in December 58, and the third time, finally, probably the most famous occasion, in Franco Zeffirelli's production at the Royal Opera House, London, in 64. So you've got three second acts of Tosca. In the Ed Sullivan Show one, it's not very impressive what she does. I think she was quite nervous. It was her first time playing an operatic character on TV. And actually, her idol, Rosa Poncel, didn't like the way she fussed with the skirt of her dress. She would say, she didn't understand why she's moving it around. Is she trying to correct its line so that it looks prettier? But I assume that's what she meant by improving its line. And I don't think that was it at all. I think Maria Callas was just trying to convey Tosca's own nature of being fidgety and fussy and nervous, you know, touching, moving, shifting around. But I do think that that performance for the Ed Sullivan Show didn't really make it as a very dramatic vehicle or a vocally impressive vehicle. And then you get to 58 in December, and there are lovely touches, elegant touches that you wouldn't expect to see in Tosca. So when she sings Visi d'arte, she, you know, it ends, perché, perché, signor, perché mi rimuneri così. And then the così, she claps her hands together. And then on the Z of così, she interlocks her fingers so that it matches the beats of the music, which is incredibly beautiful. And also, I think she does it here, and she does it later on in the Zeffirelli Tosca. So as we know, she stabs Scarpia. Scarpia's lying on the ground, and she sets candles at his flanks. And when she does it, she slides her hands across the ground. So the hand that is holding the candle that sets it slides across the ground, which is a very theatrical, elegant gesture. So I'd say that's good acting on Tosca's part. These are all effects she is adding as she gets to know Tosca more and more. So I think there was always this question in her head of, okay, I need to be Tosca, who's pretty vulgar, but I didn't want to be vulgar, especially since I'm Maria Callas. I'm often perceived to be the diva that Floria Tosca is, right? So you don't want critics to attribute Tosca's vulgarity to your own vulgarity. But as she then matured into it more, if you get to the Zeffirelli Tosca of 64, there is just such murderous rage in her. But something I always found really interesting was that she's so defiant before Scarpia, who is such a powerful figure. She constantly reprimands him. She is entirely fearless. But then after he dies, after she stabs him to death, she seems frightened when she says, "Avanti a lui tremava tutta Roma." Before him, the whole of Rome trembled. Now she seems frightened of the corpse, which is a very interesting psychological choice, that she is so, 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 so fearless. And then she does it. She commits the murder. Well, I guess you could call it. I mean, it's a pretty self-defense murder when you think about it. I mean, he was, you know, blackmailing her into sleeping with him. So it was kind of rape. So it's pretty justified, but she kills him. And then she thinks, what have I done? So it's amazing to hear that in her voice, the gelid fear, the realization. So I think ultimately she consummated that role. I mean, she led it to perfection. I'm not sure the same can be said for every role Callas ever sang, especially if she only sang it once, or, you know, in one series of performances.
And obviously she worked with many, many different types of directors, and there are a few that did have an influence on the development of her acting versus just her voice. So who were those that influenced her?
Well, this is a major question. I actually think an entirely separate book could be written about Callas and directors. And I will say, first of all, that she wanted to be, to a degree, she wanted to have that influence. So at one point, she was the one who recruited Greek theater director Alexis Minotis, who was famously married to the actress Katina Paksinou, a Greek theater and film actress. She said, I want you to direct Medea. I want a director of film and theater. I want someone like Franco Zeffirelli or Jean Vilar, because the directors who are directing opera and just opera per se, in her words, they apparently didn't really understand what they were doing, at least in this conversation with Inautis, who had no desire to direct opera until she really urged him to do it. So she took definitely, I mean, every single performing artist and every single creative artist is always taking from others, whether it's, as she herself would say, you know, that she can even look at a cabaret dancer and think, what can I get from that movement and that presentation? So if we pick up the subject of Zeffirelli, I mean, I think again, you know, probably at least, I don't know, a short book could even be written just about that 64 to 65 series of Zeffirelli Toscas. Yeah, he added a lot of detail. He made her look at the knife to extend the tension when Tosca was considering killing Scarpia. He provided her with this beautiful Indian stole that he'd found in an Indian shop in London, so that she'd have something to move with, something to fidget with. But there were also elements that she and Tito Gobbi created together. Like, for instance, Gobbi, as he later recalled, grabbing Tosca's arms and spreading them out to crucify her. And also at one point she stumbled, she slipped and kind of half fell down, so that she fell onto her knees and she clawed her way back up his arm, and Gobbi Scarpia pushed her down again. So Zeffirelli contributed to that. He also staged a Traviata with Callas. I think this must have been, although I may be wrong, but it's the first Traviata I've heard of, in 58 in Dallas, where it begins as a flashback. Now, if you listen to the music, the prelude is very similar to the prelude of the last act. So it is a flashback. But I mean, it began with Violetta on stage in bedridden and dying. So by all means, Zeffirelli contributed, but I would say no one did as good a job and no one was as insistent as Visconti. And you can even feel that, even though there's no video, again, with the exception of very, very tiny snippets that are silent footage of a Visconti Callas operatic production. But those photographs, with the amount of detail on the mantelpiece, you know, the flowers on the table, or everybody's gowns, and where relevant, if we mention La Vistale, the Greek pillars in Anna Bolena, the Tudor towers, it is astonishing. And that's because Visconti used paintings to create his own tableau. So if you've ever seen a Visconti film, you have a good idea of what a Visconti operatic production would be. And my favorite one, I think it's probably every Callas lover's favorite one, is the Traviata from 55 at the Scala, where he was so particular. He would write her notes during, for instance, the letter scene when she's writing to Alfredo. So, you know, sing this phrase, turn your head to the right, cry a little bit, sing this phrase, turn your head to the left, write some more in the letter. He would actually be sitting in the box in the theater during the performance and whispering little commandments to her. And she would, when she got the opportunity, she would whisper, shut up. There were various little details that for the time seemed revolutionary. When you think about them now, you think, well, that's a pretty obvious detail. For instance, Violetta, once all the guests had left her party in the first act, took off her shoes and rubbed her feet. And this was taken from a film adaptation of the play, a famous play called Filomena Marturano. When the critics at the time saw that, they thought it was outrageous in 1955 that a woman on stage should be taking off her high heels and rubbing her feet. And she overheard them at dinner. Callas was at dinner with her friends Giovanna Lomazzi and Anna Veronese. She overheard them saying, what is going on at the Scala? This is worse than the Togni circus. So she looked under the table and she told her friends, Anna, Giovanna, all of us are barefoot. You think we were at home, to illustrate her point. That was Visconti's recommendation. That wasn't something she suggested. And there were other moments that I don't think you would even get in a contemporary Traviata, even though today we have very risky and risque productions where singing a Forse Lui, she's removing the pins from her hair and her jewels, kind of after a long day, after the fatiguing party. And she's just contemplating, because that's what it is, it's a contemplation. That suggestion, I assume, I don't know if this was Callas's initiative or Visconti's, it was something that Carlo Maria Giulini, the conductor, described. It sounds like something Visconti would suggest, that level of realism. But you know, this was something that Callas had wanted to do herself for a while. What was it? I think at the one point she wanted to, well, she wanted to sing Casadiva in a far less presentational way, and she didn't do it for fear that it would be too controversial. And then I don't remember, there was something she wanted to sing with her back to the audience, because the aim of Visconti's productions, and also Callas's aim to a degree, was to put opera into this Stanislavski four-wall theater aesthetic. So I don't know the audiences there. I'm not going to present the aria or even the Cabaletta to the audience. I'm living this role. And they did have conflicts. They were very different artists. So at first she didn't like the dress. It's a gorgeous red gown with lots of silk and taffeta. There are mostly only black and white pictures of it. I think the colored ones are just colorized versions. I don't think they were naturally in color. They probably couldn't have been at the time. And the rustling was interfering with her hearing. So she told Visconti, but instead of changing the costume, he altered her movements. And when you think about it, it seems balletic to me that in addition to having to think about singing this incredibly difficult music, and also, this is a whole other topic that I won't touch on for too long, but there were claques there. So there were groups of people who would be hired by rivals, managers, to boo, to heckle her. And this happened to all artists back then, all performing singers. I don't know if it happened to actors, but it happened to her. It happened to Tibaldi. Happened to everyone at La Scala and in other Italian opera theaters and also theaters around the world. So considering, you know, you're singing the most difficult music ever in one of the most dramatic plots ever before an incredibly demanding audience, among whom will be paid, people paid to boo you, to bring you down, to boo at the highest note, which in Traviata was the gioia, the, you know, the whole roulade on gioia. And in addition to that, thinking, I have to move a particular way in my dress so I can hear well. And when you consider also that Callas was myopic, which hasn't been mentioned in this podcast yet, that, you know, it's just this whole just enormous gamut of responsibilities. But she would fight for her tastes. So he wanted her to put on a bonnet when Violetta, in her death scene, when she's saying, come on, let's go out, just before she dies, he said she should put on her bonnet first. And she thought it would be ridiculous. She thought, why am I going to put on my bonnet first? But a lot of beauty came out of that collaboration. Violetta died standing up, which was astonishing when you think about it. But they had squabbles there. They also had squabbles when he directed Iphigenia in Tauris, Iphigenia in Tauride in Italian. He wanted to use a wind machine that she hated. But I do believe that the most beautiful productions were by Visconti, because they had a wealth of detail that no others did. And she was also very willing to take enormous risks to create dramatic verity. So when she was directed by Margherita Wahlmann in Medea, Margherita Wahlmann wanted Maria splayed out on a ramp with her head at the bottom of the ramp with a lovely red-headed wig. And actually, I remember when I was 16, I watched a DVD of the Met production of Lucia that had Anna Netrebko doing something like that. But I don't think there was a ramp. I think she was just hanging her head from the front of the stage, doing Spargi d'amaro pianto, which was, you know, very difficult. Very difficult to sing lying, also hanging your head off something. But yeah, Callas would do it, even though she. In that instance, with the ramp at the bottom of which she had to be lying, she told Margherita Wahlmann, this is impossible, I can't do it. But she would push herself. she would push herself and she would accomplish it. But yeah, and while we're on the topic of risks, one of the most beautiful, I mean, to me, Violette and Norma were her most beautiful. Well, no, that's not true. Those were her favorite creations. My favorite creations of Callas are Violette and Norma and Chocho San. And also Manon Lescaut, even though that was only on record, never on stage. And I'm sure I'm blanking on the others, but Carmen was very good too. But if we just go back to risks, she would, in Violetta's last act, she would thin the timbre down to, she herself called it a thread kind of quality. And she was very touched when a nurse from a tuberculosis ward wrote to her saying, yes, that is the way tuberculosis patients speak or breathe, because a critic had misunderstood and thought, well, Callas ran out of breath in that scene. It's incredibly risky for the voice and risky just to expose the public to that in the hope that they will understand, because many a time the public and all the critics will not understand. Mm-hmm. So directors definitely had an impact. I am so happy that Visconti really made her his little muse. He really did. But he himself said, where did she learn her gestures? On her own. So he was very happy to give her that credit. He wasn't trying to steal her thunder. And the Zeffirelli Tosca was gorgeous. It's a shame that there is no video footage of his Dallas Traviata. She did work with some really, really good directors. And it's a whole other topic, but she was very scornful of the directors she was seeing in the early to mid 70s, of the more modern productions.
And sort of to veer slightly away from the music, just because I think people might be interested. Obviously, she did get married, but then she had this affair with Aristotle Onassis. What did she gain from that?
Well, I should say that while Onassis was by no means a musical person, I spoke to both his step-niece, Marilena Patronicolas, and his and Callas's physiotherapist, Corina Spanidou, who both told me, not knowing that, I don't think they know each other, they both told me how Onassis loved Castadiva, how he loved hearing Callas rehearse on the Christina, and how he enjoyed Bach. Now, of course, I know that he did not love music that much. But if we just go through this chronologically, so when Mary Callas met her husband, Giovanni Battista Meneghini, there was a 25-year age gap between them. She had obviously been, as we know, not really parented by either of her folks, to put it mildly. I haven't spoken much about her father, George, but he, even when she later met up with him upon her return to New York in 1945, he was not really up for playing the father figure. And if you listen to an interview that he gave to the New York TV host High Gardner, who had his own show back then, I think on NBC, he can't remember. I don't know if most people realize this, but he gets the dates of both his daughters' birthdays wrong, which is quite atypical for even, you know, not the best father. He didn't interfere when Evangelia was especially cruel with either Maria or Jackie. So she didn't have that. And when she met Meneghini, she was really looking for love. I mean, she had just arrived in Italy. She was very alone. She needed support. She needed emotional support. He was there to give her that. She also needed financial support. And he suggested quite early on in their courtship that he could act as her manager, despite the fact that Meneghini, first of all, had no experience being any kind of impresario in the opera world or ballet, for that matter, or theater or film or any of the arts. And also did not like opera particularly. So in one of her letters to him, she actually goes him to listen to a radio broadcast of hers. She says, oh, do have a listen if you can. And it's quite apparent. And later on, she would, I don't know if she noticed, but I know from people's interviews that Meneghini would be there when she was recording a studio record, falling asleep. And it's so hard for us to, you know, I can't imagine myself falling asleep when if Callas is recording, you know, 3 meters away from me, and here is her husband falling asleep. So I should mention, because I believe this hasn't been touched on sufficiently enough, I don't think she was a very sexual woman. And I mention that just because it's hard for people to understand why she, first of all, hooked up with Meneghini, who was very much older, very unattractive man, quite overweight, pretty almost bald by the time of their meeting. And then also Onassis, who was also known to be very unattractive, short, pretty pudgy. So not the best get unless you're, you know, what was back then known as a gold digger, which she totally wasn't, not to mention the fact that by the time she met Onassis, she was very well off in her own right. So when she was, you know, when she was in that mindset of do I go on a date or not, she was not really paying much heed to the physical appearance of the man. I think also she, you know, she was myopic. She was literally myopic. And I don't know how much, she didn't like to wear contact lenses at all. She never wore them on stage. She once accidentally wore them and then regretted it and got very scared of being able to see the audience because she didn't want to. So she was looking for this father figure. She found him in Meneghini, and she totally believed he was her rock. I mean, the question of was Meneghini more advantageous or disadvantageous for Callas's career is a good one, because I do think that she herself would have been quite terrible trying to sort out her own business affairs. She was a bit flaky in that regard, because she didn't want to deal with money. She didn't, you know, she didn't always know how much to tip somebody. At the same time, she could be very extravagant and very generous. So she wasn't stingy at all. But she, like many artists, including, I will say, me, actually, just did not have particularly any kind of relationship with money, did not know where to allot what amount. And Meneghini took that over. Now, she didn't realize that he was taking that over in his own interest. He himself later said he was himself, he owned 12 brick factories in Italy, came from a big, big brick factory family. He said that managing her was like managing a set of bricks, which obviously is not a very romantic analogy. And what that meant, well, not what that meant, but he was not from the opera world. He didn't understand that he needed to employ a certain amount of courtesy. So he could be very demanding. And a lot of his demanding behavior had a very negative impact on her reputation, especially when she would have conflicts with various opera houses, including the Met, where she famously got fired by manager Rudolf Bing. Also, he would write letters in her name. A lot of the letters that actually get auctioned these days, they're not from Maria Callas. They have his false signature. He would forge her signature. So that was both good and bad for her career. But the problems began, the true problems with their relationship, not just her reputation, began when he really, she said it herself, glory went to his head. He got drunk on his own power. So by the time Maria Callas was super famous, she wasn't just getting opera engagement offers. Carl Foreman offered her a role in The Guns of Navarone, the film that would eventually star Irene Pappas and Gregory Peck. Mm-hmm. And she was getting offers to sing more than just opera. Someone wanted her to do the Las Vegas circuit. And Meneghini was very enthusiastic. You know, he wanted Callas in Las Vegas. And he did not understand that she had artistic principles. And it's so funny when you think about it, because I mean, you know, I'm a writer. I can't understand. I couldn't envisage myself with a guy who didn't understand that about me. But it was a very different time, and she was a workaholic, and you know, she'd had no examples. She'd grown up, she wasn't a big reader. She'd grown up during the war. I mean, where did she hear about relationships? She didn't even find out how babies were conceived until the age of 18. She truly didn't understand that process. She didn't understand what reproduction was. Her mother didn't tell her anything, you know. There was no father. There was no TV. She didn't read. And all the radio was about the war. So she didn't have any exemplary couples that really told her what a rapport was about. So I was talking about the real problems. So in 1959, Meneghini was becoming quite bullish in his insistence that she perform at a time when she was already facing acute vocal problems. So her vocal problems, depending on how you analyze them, I think you can already hear them a bit in August 54 from a recording of La Forza del Destino, from a studio recording of that. But they became more and more apparent in 57, especially 58. And by that time, she was already diminishing her number of appearances by a lot. And she herself actually announced in June 1958 that in a TV show, in a British TV show, no, or was it a radio? Only the audio is preserved, but I think it was originally a TV show. I will sing a lot less. I will not retire completely, but I will sing a lot less. Partly because, in her view, the operatic standards were very low and they were just declining with every passing year. But also, something she wouldn't admit at the time, the fact that she was facing terrible vocal problems you could already hear in her recordings. Whereas Merighini didn't care about any of that at all, wanted her to perform in Las Vegas, wanted her to agree to film roles. And when she said no, he said, well, who cares about, music and the stage? Land is what matters. Land is what land, you get to keep land. A performance is not forever. And this hurt her deeply. And at one point, it was actually, this is hard to believe, but it truly was a coincidence. They had firstly been, she and Merighini had been invited to go on a cruise by Larry Kelly, who had founded the Dallas Civic Opera, longtime friend of hers. But Merighini had preferred to accept another invitation from Aristotle Onassis and his wife, Tina. So they went on that cruise. And I don't know. I honestly don't know when Onassis decided to pursue Callas, but I can tell you she was oblivious to it completely. She was exhausted. She was completely exhausted. She'd had various health problems. She'd had, nervous exhaustion because of things that had been blown out of proportion in the press to do with her conflicts with opera houses. She had been performing nonstop in a way in which I think most contemporary opera singers don't even dare to perform. So the idea of cheating on her husband firstly wouldn't enter her mind because I don't think she'd have the inclination. She was not a very sexual woman. It's not going to, she's not going to have much to resist from that perspective. Secondly, she was quite a moral woman, so also not going to enter her mind from that viewpoint. And it was at that point that Carl Foreman proposed the Guns of Navarone, and then Merighini started pushing her to do it, and she said, no, I don't want to. And he explained that he had invested their money, which was basically her money at this point, because I forgot to mention that when Merighini full-time became Callas's manager, he gave up his own business. He parted ways with his family's brick factory enterprise. So it was her money. And he was investing it in paintings without her knowledge because she had said, well, do what you think is best. I trust you. You're financially savvy. And it turned out that these paintings had been forgeries. And Callas, who was very, very naive in matters of, the male-female relationship, truly turned to Onassis for advice. She had just met this man and they were having nice conversations about being Greek, about their experiences with hardship. Onassis had also had terrible adversity. He was much older than she was, but he had terrible. He'd been in jail during the Smyrna War, so he'd had terrible adversity. And she'd asked Onassis, "Can you, help my husband out? He's invested in these forgeries." And Merighini did not like to see that they were becoming friends, and that is all they were truly at this point. They were friends, and Callas were completely oblivious to the idea that there could be anything more. And Merighini got very angry. He would later forge a diary of events, and it was truly forged. He took paper, letterheaded paper from their apartment at Via Michelangelo Buonarroti, 44 in Milan, and he handwrote. He would scribble dates and just, with the same pen, write an account of events saying, "Maria Callas cheated on me. I caught her and us together. She's left me." And that is not what happened at all. On the contrary, she wanted to preserve the marriage, and he wanted out because he said, "If I don't get if I don't have control over your finances, we're over." And truly, it was his initiative. He ended that marriage. And she was flabbergasted. She was absolutely dumbstruck. It was this total volte-face, like a neo-realistic, like a Roberto Rossellini film. It was horrifying that this character in her life, who she thought had been her rock, turned out to be an absolute egregious monster. And it was only, firstly, she depended on Onassis for friendship. And also, his wealth, of course, accorded him the comfort of allowing her to use his private jet when the paparazzi were going after her like crazy, as well as the Christina. Yeah, it definitely made it look like they were having an affair, but they weren't at that time. Their relationship began much later. And contrary to what many people believe, he did not suspend her career. I mean, I don't even understand why anyone would think Onassis wanted to do that. Because even if you're just thinking of him as a guy who wants to be with a famous, beautiful woman, if she doesn't have a career, who is she? She's just a has-been, right? So at the beginning of their relationship, he proposed that she have some influence over the Monte Carlo Opera House. She was interested in that idea. And then later on, as her vocal problems grew more and more acute, he he and her manager, Sandra Gorlinski, corresponded about the possibility of a Maria Callas television company where she would have the opportunity to pre-record concerts in advance so that she didn't suffer such terrible nerves. He also got on very well with Herbert von Karajan, with whom Callas had actually had a few artistic squabbles during their Lucia. And Callas lovers will know that at some point she considered doing a film version of Tosca to be directed by Zeffirelli. Zeffirelli in his memoir wrote that Onassis was the one who put a stop to the project, but that is not true. He and Callas actually kind of simulated this argument because she wanted out of it, but Onassis wanted her to star in it. He thought it was a good investment. And even as late as 1967, he and her manager, Sandra Gorlinski, were exchanging letters saying, oh, why is it so difficult to convince Maria to star in this Tosca film? So he absolutely did not want to suppress her talent. He was not, it is absolutely true that he was not musical and that later on they had arguments and they would attack each other's characters and they would attack each other's, you know, professions as well. Unfortunately, that happens when you have two very, very strong and headstrong personalities that clash. But he actually tried to help her kind of preserve a career that was in a terrible struggle because of her vocal problems.
And if we turn to, you've obviously mentioned her vocal decline. If we go to the sort of the latter years of her life, and she did die quite young, what did that look like, you know, somewhat post-career and post-relationships?
It wasn't so much post-career just because she never officially retired.
Right.
She was always singing. When I interviewed Onassis' step niece and physiotherapist, they both said that Callas sang on the Christina. This was, you know, even after the final full operatic performance of Tosca in July 65 in London. She would practice singing for at least 5 hours a day on the Christina on Onassis' yacht. Sorry, I think I forgot to mention the Christina is Onassis' yacht. I seem to think that was something everybody knew. So the Christina was Onassis' yacht. And also, even after my book came out, there was a Greek interview with a woman who had lived on an island that had been frequented by the Christina, and she remembered hearing Callas rehearse
Wow.
from the yacht. Yeah,
that's amazing.
I didn't get to. I know, and she's still alive, and I didn't get to include that because this Greek article came out after my book came out. And I also want to mention, because it is always stated that Onassis dumped Callas for Jackie Kennedy. That did not happen. They were on the outs. Callas and Onassis were on the outs. They were having terrible arguments. Part of it was because every time he would receive a famous, shall we say, luminary on the yacht, he didn't want her there because she had this kind of, you know, illegitimate status as someone who wasn't his wife. And also he and his first wife, Athena, Tina Livanus, had been on the outs when he had decided to pursue Maria Callas. So she was not a homewrecker, as they say, because I've actually seen people write that about her, which is so untrue. Ultimately, she dumped him one summer. And at that point, he was already entertaining the idea of an engagement with Jackie Hendy. But it was not the case that he just dumped her. They were not together when that engagement was announced. They were already not together, and he was already trying to get her back through a series of phone calls and dispatches of bouquets, you know, desperate messages, and she was not going back. So, you know, they continue to have a close friendship. They did not rekindle their romantic relationship, but they continued a close friendship until his death. So what happened was, it was a terrible time for her after the Tosca, while she and Onassis were still a couple, after the Tosca in 65, because she could hear her voice declining more and more and more. And what a lot of people don't know is that apart from the possibility, there is a possibility that the quickness of the weight loss, the fact that it happened so quickly, may have contributed to her decline, not because it could have, it didn't affect her vocal cords, didn't affect her diaphragm, but some of the muscles around the, you know, in that area of the diaphragm. It's possible that some of the muscles shifted when she lost the weight loss, and that she she was forced, she was basically resonating the wrong place. But I mean, in the or using the wrong muscle, shall we say. It's very difficult though. I didn't want to speculate about that too much in the book because I'm not a laryngologist. And even if I were, she's dead. So I've got nothing to examine. But she also had really serious health problems, serious for the voice, that is. She had terrible sinus problems. Where and she said that the mucus would kind of drip onto the vocal cords. Her resonance chambers were not working, so she started to force her voice. And if you listen to her recordings from 61, you can really hear this. She sounds so nasal. She sounds like she's, congested. And that's because she's having a terrible sinusitis problem. She had to undergo an operation for that. I think it was a day after a Medea at La Scala. So, when people say Maria Callas sang less because she was with Onassis and leading a life of luxury, I mean, oh my gosh, she's suffering with sinusitis and she's undergoing an operation right after a performance. That doesn't sound like someone who is living the high life and avoiding the stage because she's having so much fun. That was actually not the case. She was really torn about what engagements to accept. There were so many she entertained. There was an American tour in she wanted to do in 63. And when you read that correspondence between her and her manager Sandra Gorlinsky, that I discovered that is one of the rare collections of correspondence that has truly never surfaced anywhere. She is just, every single letter is basically this attempt at changing something to facilitate the performance. Okay, let's postpone it a bit more. Oh, can I begin in a city like Philadelphia as opposed to New York? Because I don't want to open in Carnegie Hall because that'll be so much pressure. The media will be all over me. This is someone who's suffering so much every day, getting up, listening to her voice, recording herself because she did a lot of that. She recorded herself a lot. So she had the sinus problems. And then she had a hernia, a stomach hernia, which was later described as a hiatal hernia. But to be honest, I'm not even sure if that was a separate new hernia or the same one. She had an operation for the first hernia in January 63. And as soon as the operation was over, she's got her tape recorder and she's, singing, listening to herself, trying to figure out if the sound has changed. I did try to contact her doctors, but unsurprisingly, no one replied because they're not supposed to. It's, the confidentiality of the profession. So I'm going by what she said and what she told her friends. So, hiatal hernia, sinusitis, generally also, as a lot of callous lovers will know, sudden drops in blood pressure, which really affected a Norma in Paris in 65. When she was about to collapse. One of them had to be suspended because she was just truly on the verge of collapsing. So she had health problems. And singing was who she was. She was rehearsing all the time for herself. She was training with Herbert Hidalgo, who had been her coach since the age of going back to about 38, so since the age of about 14. And she wanted to return to the stage, and she did return to the recording studio, but she wouldn't like her sound and she would stop the record from coming out. And she had even been doing this at the peak of her career, the Manon Lescaut from 57. I think it's one of the greatest Callas records, one of the greatest records of all time. She postponed its release. She didn't like it. She postponed its release to 59. I find that crazy. But she was a perfectionist and she could not allow what she felt was subpar performances to be released, let alone come on stage with them. She continued to study, I also want to add, various bel canto roles, including Donizetti's Lucrezia Borgia, Maria di Rohan, Elizabeth di Inghilterra. She even continued studying German, which she didn't actually learn. She never did manage to speak German, but, with the idea of going back to Wagner. So at some point, of course, she understood that wasn't going to happen. And it's incredibly sad because she was just so bored, but she was incredibly sad. Who am I if I'm not a singer? So she, as many will know, undertook the project of Pier Paolo Pasolini's film Medea, which has nothing to do with the opera and also doesn't have that much to do with Euripides' play when you think about it. I mean, it's a very Pasolini film. So Pasolini enjoyed using real people as opposed to actors to play the roles. And alongside her was Giuseppe Gentile, who had been an Olympic jumper in the role of Jason. And this is where the self-contradictions really start to accumulate, because if you read the press for Medea, Callas says, oh, I had such a fun time. I didn't have any of those constraints that opera brings. You know, and I got to magnify my expression for the camera lens. Oh no, the opposite. Sorry, I was doing the opposite. I got to minimize my expression for the camera lens, because when you're on camera, it can't be that theatrical as it is on stage.
Right.
I had a very, very enjoyable experience, bonded with my castmates. And then in real life, she told the mezzo, Juliette Simignato, that she had felt lost doing it. And she also told EMI France's Thérèse Dara, whom I interviewed, that she had felt like, I think she told her that her teeth and nails had been taken away from her. So she felt she'd lost her wings. She felt she'd lost flight in this experience. I feel like that's something you can detect when you see the movie. I know that some critics out there think she's good. I have to say, I disagree as both an opera critic, a music critic, and also just a real film lover. I don't think she's good in that. So even though she got many more offers, she was offered, was it called Boom? The film with Elizabeth Taylor based on Tennessee Williams' play, I think it's called Boom. She would offer Boom. She would offer a film based around an Edgar Allan Poe story, a chance to work with the French director Joseph Losey, right. I was confusing a Callas biographer with a French film director there. She did not want to venture back into that, despite the fact that she wasn't willing to open up about her struggles publicly. And then, as is maybe better known, especially in America, where these masterclasses took place, in October 71, she gave a series of masterclasses. Well, it was 6 weeks from October to November 71, and then another 6 weeks from February to March 72. And if you listen to them on YouTube, and thankfully they are available in their entirety, you probably think she's having fun, and maybe she is to a degree, but she found it very, very draining. And her chauffeur, who was actually also, it was a coincidence, her chauffeur ended up being one of the Juilliard students. He auditioned not without telling her. Her chauffeur, Marco Lampas, didn't tell her he also happened to be a student at Juilliard, and then came to audition for her masterclasses and surprised her. And she took him because he had a good voice. She didn't take him out of, you know, favoritism. But he would remember she was so drained after the classes. And I know that she would tell Dallas music critic, John Ardoin, the Dallas music critic, would later say she would be so tired that she would make up an excuse and say, Mr. Ardoin and I have an appointment, because she didn't want to stay, you know, with all the attention, because these classes were given to the public, but she hadn't realized that was going to be the case. Even though if you look at the Juilliard correspondence, it's quite clear that they're going to arrange that. But I guess, I don't know, her mind drew a blank. She was very stunned that that happened. So it so happened that a lot of celebrities attended these classes, including Domingo, Pavarotti, who, you know, both of them were just coming into their careers, Bido Sayal, Zeffirelli, of course, her old colleagues Gobbi, the conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, Lillian Gish, the actress, and Ben Gazzara. You know, these were star-studded events, and she had anticipated that they would merely be instructional classes. Mm-hmm. So that was very draining because, firstly, I don't think she really wanted to teach. I mean, she was a performer first and foremost, and, you know, all the way through. Through and through, she was a performer. I don't think she particularly wanted to give that. I mean, I don't mean it for it to sound as though she was selfish, but there are some singers and actors and other performing artists who really want to give that to someone, as in try to improve someone else's talent. I don't think she was particularly interested in improving students' talents, even though I should add that many were very, very grateful for what they gave her, including the soprano Barry Smith, who had actually been previously told that she was a mezzo. And she was actually writing a book about her own friendship with Callas before she passed. Unfortunately, she passed away before she could tell me about that. Maria would be on the phone with these students. She would help them prepare for a student production of La Boheme. So she was very involved. And I think she does do a good job. I recently recorded a whole other podcast. I'll give a shout out to the Opera We Love Singing podcast with Ricardo. We'd recently did a whole episode on Callas and Judah, trying to analyze if she was a good teacher or not. And she obviously had very good qualities, but she just did not want to be there, I think, as a final analysis of that. She tried directing a production of I Vespri Siciliani with Giuseppe Di Stefano, with whom she later had a romantic relationship. Well, with whom she eventually had a romantic relationship also, and found it very hard. She would mostly concentrate on the soprano Raima Kabaivanska and teach her Elena, the heroine's movement, because she didn't really know about that either. And that production got mixed reviews, but the negative ones were really very much pans. She really felt out of place, and it's horrible. It was horrible for me to read about her, to witness her, also in interviews, just becoming more defensive, more self-contradictory, more anxious, more on edge, and also to read about that, and also to write about that. But even though she and Di Stefano later began a concert tour from 73 to 74, it was a major concert tour, but her voice was in shreds because the support in her stomach, so presumably her stomach muscles, had been damaged. She had worked very hard to recover it. Her physiotherapist told me, and I also read this in Giuseppe Gentile, the actor who played Jason in Pasolini's Medea. I read in his book also, and I also saw in an interview with Pasolini's then lover, Nico, his name was Ninetto Davoli, right, Ninetto Davoli. All three of these people remember Maria Callas at different times of her life, saying, "I have been working on breathing, on these breathing exercises to strengthen my stomach muscles. Punch me. Punch my stomach as hard as you can." And they were really hard. Her physiotherapist told me, yeah, they were like steel. But unfortunately, she couldn't recover that support in the stomach muscles. Her vocal cords were, as she herself said, perfect. And then I think actually if you hear her sing in those last concerts, she sings so perfectly. But the problem is there is no voice there. There is nothing wrong with the technique. She is doing everything she was doing throughout her career. Legato, beautiful portamenti. So the sliding from one note to another. Beautiful ornaments and the expression most of the time, not always, because sadly, nerves would get the better of her from time to time, of course, in this condition. So I'm not going to recommend those concerts, to be honest, to any Callas lovers. And they're mostly available. They were recorded on pirate tapes, most of them. The London one from December 72, one of the two London ones, was videoed and is on, is everywhere. It's on YouTube. They have everywhere on the internet, in the internet. But there was no body in the voice. The voice had no corporal entity. So that was the tragedy. That was Maria Callas's tragedy, and she felt very lost. Even though she continued to train. I haven't mentioned another vocal coach, fabulous vocal coach, Janine Reiss, my very first interviewee when I was 19 years old. I had just turned 19. She welcomed me to her apartment in Paris. She passed away, I think it was 5 years ago, maybe 4.5 years ago. So she didn't live to see my book, but she was a very, very gracious lady. She prepared Callas for the French album, the French compilation album she recorded. Lovely French artists, mainly mezzo artists, but not all. And she was preparing her also for the role of Charlotte, because Callas wanted to record Charlotte in the very last days of her life. I mean, she wanted to. I don't believe a recording date had been set, but that was the plan. And she saw Callas 2 days before, was it a day before her death? Well, by the time Janine arrived, she was flying to New York to do work there, I think at the Met. And a man at the airport, the porter who was carrying her luggage, told her Maria Callas had died without knowing that Janine Reiss had anything personally to do with Maria Callas. So, even reading those, editing and proofreading those last chapters was always hard for me because of what happened, even though I know full well what did happen.
So,
sorry,
what?
Everybody, I do talk a lot, so I'm sorry if I have rambled.
That's okay. You know what? The book itself, of course, goes into great detail. And I think if you are a lover of Callas, I mean, my goodness, there's just so, and I think in this podcast, you've talked about so many different aspects It's riveting. I find it riveting. So, yes, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thanks so much again to Sophia Lambton for spending time with me to talk about her book. Now, Maria Callas was a powerhouse, and I do encourage you to pop onto YouTube and revisit her prowess with some of the archival footage and recordings that are now available. They really do still blow my mind. Now, this book is available on Amazon in your country, so please look it up and pick up a copy. Until next time.